This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other courses or to access other materials from RTS, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.
All right. Lecture 19. We come to the last section of the book of Leviticus, which is a term, the holiness code, and that term circles back to critical scholars, but it is a fairly good name for it, so I've used it here. And this is more holiness lived in daily life. And so the character of the regulations here deals more with our relationship with our neighbors, generally volitional choices we make are more involved, although not totally, you can't totally omit that from 11 through 16. Holiness meets the marketplace would be a significant factor in these chapters. Now, this is a part of Leviticus where people sort of wonder about the structure. And I think I have in your notes something that looks like this. This sort of helps us to some degree see the relationship between sections. You've got sacrifices and blood in 17, followed by three sections. And the first and the third sections are parallel with each other. You have the same thing down here, priests and sacrifices, followed by three sections, and the first and the third section seem to be at least related to each other, and the middle section seems to have a particular emphasis. So this is sort of one way to look at the structure here. Sacrifices and blood, sexual relationships, a variety of relationships in Leviticus 19, and then sexual relationships with a penalty, priests and sacrifices, the religious calendar in 23, Sabbath and Jubilee years in 25, and then in the middle, a variety of topics, but the emphasis may be honor God at all times. And then you have covenant blessings and cursings and the redemption of vows. The way we're going to approach this section is to sort of do it in a thematic way. We're not going to go chapter by chapter, but we're going to take up broad themes and talk about them, and under some of these themes we will cover the material in these chapters. The first theme to consider: holiness is the intersection of life and worship. Now, there's one sense in which all of life is worship, but there's another sense in which worship is a very particular activity that we do, related here to the tabernacle. And so this is talking about holiness involves the intersection of life and worship. What goes on in the tabernacle has an impact on what the Israelites do in their daily lives. You see that in chapter 17, which deals with sacrifices, eating meat, and the significance of blood. And so to look at the contents of chapter 17, the first part of the chapter, especially verses 3 through 9, no domestic animal is to be killed outside the tabernacle. So, if you want to have meat for supper while you're in transit to the promised land, you've got to bring the animal, if it's a domestic animal, you've got to bring that animal to the tabernacle to be slaughtered, probably as a fellowship offering, so you would get a portion of that meat in return. Verse 7 gives the motive: to keep the Israelites from offering sacrifices to the goat idol. There must have been some temptation in the wilderness to worship the goat idol. And if they would have been allowed to sacrifice animals outside the tabernacle, perhaps they would have been tempted to offer it to the goat idol. And so they must bring their sacrifices. All of their domestic animals had to be slain at the tabernacle. The second part of chapter 17, no blood is to be eaten by the Israelites because of the role of the blood in the sacrificial system. If you were taking this course during a semester, you would have had to have memorized chapter 17, verse 11. The life of the flesh is in the blood, and I've given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul. And because of the role of blood in the sacrificial system, the Israelites were not to eat blood. And so they had to slaughter the animal in such a way that would drain the blood. And then the last part of chapter 17, wild animals did not have to be sacrificed at the tabernacle, but their blood could not be eaten. So if you ate an animal that died naturally, or if the blood was not drained properly, that would make you unclean. Now, it didn't make you unclean for a real long time, but you could be unclean. But if the blood was drained properly and it was not one of the animals that was forbidden, then that would have been okay. The intersection of life and worship. What you do in your daily life is affected by what goes on at the tabernacle. Blood is not to be eaten in everyday life because of its theological significance in worship. You can't divorce your life from worship. The two are related. So that's a theme, I think, that comes out especially of chapter 17. And, of course, we would hope that our lives are not separated from worship either. That what we do in worship has an impact on how we live our daily lives. Now, we've already mentioned this. We don't have to worry about eating meat with blood in it anymore. Christ has fulfilled the sacrificial system, and the role of blood in that sacrificial system. So, we don't have to worry about that. But this principle still is important. Life and worship. You see a similar thing in chapter 24 of Leviticus. And if you look at the content of chapter 24, you see in the first four verses, the Israelites are to bring clear oil to keep the lampstand burning. In verses 5 through 9, the priests are to change the bread on the table of showbread every week on behalf of the Israelites. So, bring oil to keep the lampstand burning in the tabernacle. Change the bread on the table of showbread every week. And then verses 10 through 23 of chapter 24, what do you do if someone blasphemes the name of God? Now, why are these regulations together? That's a major question. If you read commentary, so, you know, why are these incidents placed together here in chapter 24? Well, there may be some progression going on that makes sense here. If you go back to chapter 23, it's the religious calendar, and I think, yeah, that's correct. I think I have an appendix in this lecture that lays out the feasts. And so, you know, that's for your use, benefit later if it's helpful. But chapter 23 sets out the religious festivals for Israel, the set times of the year they are to honor God. So at set times of the year, they were to honor God at these festivals. Chapter 24 then deals with things in the tabernacle that need regular attention by the people and the priests. So 23, set times of the year, they are to honor God. 24, 1 through 9, things that need regular attention. And then 24, 10 through 23, the seriousness of honoring God at all times, with the example of a person who blaspheme the name of God, and they end up stoning him. So what chapter 24 may be stressing in context is not just set times, not just regularly, but honor God always. And then that's followed by chapter 25 with the Sabbath and Jubilee years, which would then be looking to the future. And there is, does seem to be some parallel. Chapter 24, a variety of topics, honor God at all times. And when you look at chapter 19, a variety of relationships, as we'll see when we get there. And the emphasis there is sort of be holy at all times. So that might partly explain what's going on here. Another thing. Holiness lived out in our lives causes us to be different from the world. That's especially stressed in chapter 18. The chapter that deals with sexual relationships. About seven times in this chapter it's stated they are not to do as the nations do with the phrase, I am the Lord. That's repeated six times in this chapter. And you can see specifically in chapter 18, verse 3, according to the doings of the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan. Egypt you've come from, Canaan you are going to. And it says in chapter 18, verse 6, none of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord. Now the phrase to uncover nakedness means to have a sexual relationship with, as I think the NIV translates the phrase. And so the regulations in chapter 18, you should not marry or have sexual relations with anyone who is a close blood relative, and it gives the degrees within which you can marry, or even someone who's become a close blood relative through marriage into the family. And so that's what these regulations are talking about. That marriage is in view seems clear from verse 18, where it says, you shall not take a woman as a rival to her sister. The phrase, take a woman, is characteristic phrase in the Hebrew of to marry a woman. Well, there is a verse in this chapter, or as in 20, that's right, it's with the penalties. You had it marked 2021, yes. A man takes his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He's uncovered his brother's nakedness. Now, I think the explanation of this is there may be situations outside of Levirate marriage where someone might want to marry his brother's wife. What if brother A and his wife have a son, and then brother A dies, and brother B wants to marry the wife of brother A? Well, then this regulation would come into play. Except for Levirate marriage, that's correct. Yes, except for Levirate marriage. Yes. Yes. Different context. Yeah, different context. Yeah. And I don't know if it's the exact same phrase or not. We saw the phrase in Genesis 9 related to Noah in his tent where it said he became uncovered. So it doesn't use the phrase uncover his nakedness even, but I was thinking some make the connection. I don't think there is a connection, and that's totally different for sure. But the context there would have to determine the ultimate meaning. Now, the theological rationale behind these laws is to keep Israel from acting like her neighbors. So apparently, these regulations were not adhered to by the Egyptians or the Canaanites. And there is some evidence that in Egyptian royal families, brothers married sisters. Now, you have to consider the practical considerations for Israel, where the issue, I think, was more problematic in Israel than in other cultures for several reasons. The Israelites were not to intermarry with foreigners, with those who believed or did not believe in Yahweh, which maybe reduced the number of candidates for marriage. Plus, many times inheritance and land issues were involved. Land to remain within the family may have necessitated the contemplation of marriage with closer relatives. And so the Bible for Israel lays out, don't marry within these degrees. Now, there's wisdom in these regulations from a practical standpoint. And generally, most societies have laws on the books that prohibit marriage between people who are real closely related. There's a 30% more risk of mental handicap or other serious defect where parents are siblings, and there's a 4% risk when parents are first cousins. So there does seem to be generally some wisdom in these regulations. The Westminster Confession of Faith has a statement related to these degrees of consanguinity, blood relatives, or affinity, married relatives, that are forbidden by the word. Usually, incestuous relationships are talked about in context of these regulations. And it's also interesting that the terminology of 1 Corinthians 5:1, a passage we've referred to already in this class, that the terminology of 1 Corinthians 5:1 may reflect the wording of Leviticus 18:8, where Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5:1, it is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality as is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. Perhaps a reflection there of Leviticus 18:8, someone who had married their stepmother. And so most people take seriously these regulations still today. You might also be able to apply this to the whole issue of sexual abuse. Now, I don't know if that was even a problem among the Israelites. It's more a problem in our day. But we're not to take advantage of close family members when there may be opportunity to do so. And it's said that most sexual abuse doesn't occur by strangers, but by family members or people well known by the family. And so there may be something in these regulations that you could connect to that as well. Yes?
Fathers having sex with their daughters in the fields. In the fields, so the fields will be fertile.
In which area?
Egypt, the Near East, Lebanon, and Syria.
Yeah. Yeah. Which fits in with the whole Baal thing in Canaan, too. So, yeah. And that's part of trying to understand what's going on in the culture as best we can to help us understand and helps us then relate it to today. We are to be different from the culture around us. Also in chapter 18, there is a list of what you call sexual deviations, beginning with verse 19. Verse 19, no sex during the monthly period. Verse 20, adultery. Verse 21, don't offer your children to Molech. Verse 22, homosexuality. Verse 23, bestiality. Now, it's here to some degree, and also in other places, where many have accused those who take a more conservative position of picking and choosing out of the Old Testament what we think is good and relevant and what we don't think is good and relevant. For example, how come we never talk about it's wrong to have sex during the monthly period? We're not real concerned about that, but we are very concerned about maybe adultery and homosexuality. Well, I don't think those two are really on the same level anyway, but you see what somebody might say. Well, this is where you have to understand a particular law within the context, and within the context of the Old Testament, and in a broader redemptive historical context. The law related to no sex during the period relates to the whole issue of blood, and it may be a safeguard for the woman who may need protection during that time. Whereas adultery, homosexuality, and bestiality all go back to creation. A man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. One flesh. Adultery's forbidden. God's design of creation is one man and one woman, not two men, not two women. And there's a clear distinction in Genesis 1 and 2 between animals and humans. So bestiality. See, Genesis 1 and 2 take care of those and are reinforced all throughout the rest of Scripture. There's no place in the Bible that even opens the door to the possibility of homosexuality or bestiality. Some would try to argue that, you know, it's okay if it's monogamous, a homosexual monogamous relationship, but that just goes against Genesis 1 and God's design. There's no other place in the Bible that even sort of opens the door to that. So we are not picking and choosing. This methodology is not a pick-and-choose methodology, but it's trying to understand the law in its context and in the redemptive historical sweep of things, going back to creation, which is very significant, and then looking to the New Testament. Now, it's interesting, sacrificing to Moloch occurs right in the middle of these regulations concerning the sexual relationship. And sacrificing to Moloch, you shall not sacrifice your children to Moloch. Moloch had child sacrifice. And so people wonder, well, why is this stuck right in the middle here? Well, there may be an explanation. Whenever sexual behavior becomes deviant or loose, the attitudes toward the fruit of that relationship may also change. We've experienced that. What happened in the 1960s? The sexual revolution. Freedom. Supposed freedom. Anytime, any place, with anybody. No restraints. And what do we get in the 70s? Our attitude toward the fruit of that relationship was affected. We got abortion in the 70s. So, you know, having the thing with Moloch here really makes a point that's very relevant to our own day. And when you come into the New Testament, obviously the New Testament is very concerned about this issue. In fact, I would argue in some ways our culture today is very much like Corinth, very much like the land of Canaan. Because of the prominence of this issue in our culture today. And so we're called to be salt and light in a world society that is pushing the envelope in a lot of these areas. And I've got some New Testament passages listed there that we've talked about, 1 Corinthians 6 and 1 Thessalonians 4:3, it's God's will that you should be holy and avoid sexual immorality, etc., etc. So the way we live our life is to set us apart from the world. Yes, sir.
Yeah. say that when you read about, for example, when people came into the land, you have Rahab the harlot. Mm-hmm. And he said one of the things to understand about the Canaanites' iniquity being filled is the fact that on the eastern side of Jordan, you had basically predominantly the worship of Baal. On the western side, Baal was the more prominent of the fertility gods. The underground god who would come to the surface as a result of blood. But how do you get that blood? You get that blood through the children that are produced as a result of the festivals. In other words, they would have a festival. Mm-hmm. And a young girl who had just entered into womanhood would go to the festival, and she wouldn't leave a virgin. She would be usually unimpregnated. When that child is born, it's not a guilty thing, but rather an act of worship to offer up that child, either to the Baal stone, where the child would be carved up, mm-hmm. or to Moloch, where the child would end up being burned up. What's the reason for the fruitfulness of the land type of a thing? And so that when the people of Israel entered the land, as far as the corruption of the Canaanites was concerned, you might say it was hard to find a Canaanite girl who had not been involved in worship that involved sex, that ended in murder of a child. And then you think, well, how similar is that to America today?
I don't think I have a good grasp, or we have a good grasp, at maybe how full the iniquity of the Canaanites really were. And it's good to see that. Yes?
The conservative slight, you know, for why we pick that one out of the
right.
Ministry period.
And it's just not that. It's, you know, they'll go and you're not concerned about wearing a garment that has two types of, but you're concerned about these. So it's not just here, but it's a broader principle in other parts of.
Right.
Yeah.
One question I have on this one in particular is an argument that I've heard, and I just want to understand your validity to it, is with these five things listed, that with the latter four, there's sort of scripture gives sort of its own commentary as to why you're not supposed to do it. You make yourself like pagan, you profane the name of the Lord, it's an abomination, it's a perversion. But with the first one, it doesn't really say anything, it just says don't do it. Is that just somebody trying to find something, pulling straws, or is there, and do you feel like there's any legitimacy to that?
In other words, your comment, because it says, because there's stronger statements related to the other ones. Yeah.
It says don't do it, and the other says this is why you're not supposed to do it.
Well, I do think that these things are not necessarily on the same level of heinousness, and the word abomination is not used with the first one. And usually the first one's going to occur within a husband and wife relationship probably anyway. So I think there's something to be said for that. But then I would go a step further and talk about, you know, why. You know, the role of blood is also important, as we've seen in other things and activities that they were prohibited from doing because of the issues related to blood. But I think that's a factor there, although it's not specifically mentioned. But in light of what's said about other things, I think that's probably something that relates here as well. But I would agree, I think, with your statement. All right, finally, positive things that we do as God's people set us apart, not just what we're not to do. Some of these things we've talked about are more on the negative side. Don't do these things, and that'll set you apart from the nations around you. But there are some positive things that we come to in chapter 19. But before we get to them, I usually always at least try to make some comment, although I'm not sure I've got it fully worked out or solved, some comment on Leviticus chapter 19, verses, 26, 27, and 28, where it says, in 27, you shall not shave around the sides of your head, nor shall you disfigure the edges of your beard. You shall not make any cuttings in your flesh for the dead, nor tattoo any marks on you, I am the Lord. And part of our, challenge is to understand these within the context of the Old Testament. And I think someone is doing a paper on this, so I'm looking forward to being more enlightened on this. Some of these things may reflect Canaanite practices, and a variety of explanations might be given. Some of these relate to extreme practices of grief and mourning. Cutting your body for the dead could refer to mourning practices and related to things that are associated with rituals for the dead. The tattoo marks may refer to painting the body in some way, either to prepare it to attend the ritual as a sign of belonging to a certain cult, or to ward off evil spirits. Maybe some possibilities. Do not cut the hair at the sides of your head or clip the edges of your beard. In Egypt, the hair of childhood or youth is shaved and consecrated at a shrine. You know, the way people wear their hair in some cultures can have can make a statement. And so our challenge is to understand these in their context, and then what do they mean for us today? I have an article here from World Magazine. It talks about a man who was a part of a Japanese gang. And, of course, being part of the gang, he got the tattoos. And that set him apart as a gang member. Of course, the cross, he's become a believer since those days. So it's a very, very good story. A lot of people today get tattoos just as a way for self-expression. It has nothing to do with being in a gang or maybe even any of these practices. So, you know, what's our level of exegetical certainty? Is there a principle here related to our bodies being made in the image of God, and we shouldn't necessarily deface them? Is that a principle that applies here? I know my exegetical certainty is very high if my daughter comes to me and says, "Can I get a tattoo?" And I say, "You're under my roof in my house. I'm paying for your expenses." Absolutely not. And if you do, you're in big trouble. So, you know, as father of the house, my exegetical certainty is 100%. But is my exegetical certainty as high in other places? That's part of the struggle. And if you're, you know, you're working with youth and trying to reach out to youth, and you start bringing in youth into your youth group for Bible studies, and they've got, you know, tattoos and all these things, you know, that can cause problems. And, you know, we don't necessarily want to have those things be barriers to presenting the gospel. So, you know, this raises all kinds of sticky questions that I'm not sure I've got the answer to. Maybe once the paper is written, I'll email you and tell you what the answer is. Anyway, I wanted to comment on this just so you didn't think I was trying to avoid this, because this comes up some in conversations related to today. I have heard that in about 20 years, one of the greatest, if you're going to go into business, will be removing tattoos. Because people are going to want them removed. I don't know how true that is, but I've heard that several places. All right. Well, we'll move beyond that discussion. The way we treat others sets us apart. In Leviticus 19, and here the two principles of justice and love are stressed. Justice means you pay someone promptly. You don't show partiality to the poor or to the rich. You're honest in your business dealings with others. Love means you don't mistreat people by taking advantage of their weakness. You don't mistreat the alien. You don't mistreat the deaf. You don't mistreat the blind. You don't mistreat the elderly. You show compassion. You show respect, especially for the elderly. You have compassion for those less fortunate than you. You don't seek revenge, but you speak truthfully to your neighbor when things are not right. These would be more positive things that come out of Leviticus chapter 19 that demonstrate that we as God's people are to be different from our neighbors. The rest of Leviticus, I think, we don't need to comment on chapter 26 or to comment in much depth. Chapter 26 lays out the blessings and cursings of the covenant. A very interesting chapter that's worth reading. It, along with Deuteronomy 27 and 28, are very foundational for the rest of the Old Testament in terms of the blessings of the covenant and the cursings of the covenant. And then the last chapter is a chapter related to redeeming things, keeping our vows, and the importance of that. But I don't think I'll comment anymore on the rest of Leviticus.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.